Hey there. Before we really jump into things today, just a quick heads up that this deep dive is brought to you by CERT Fuel. If you're out there gearing up for the Series 65, they've got this like full course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, all that good stuff.
It's super helpful.
Yeah, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted exactly like the real thing. It's a great resource for your prep. Definitely check it out at certfuel.com when you're not driving or studying.
Right. So to kick things off today, I want you to imagine raising hundreds of millions of dollars from investors, but like explicitly promising them that you have absolutely no idea what you were going to do with their money.
Just zero clue.
Zero clue. You just ask them for a blank check. You tell them you'll figure it out later. And somehow Wall Street and the SEC regulators are just like, yeah, sure, that's perfectly legal.
It sounds a bit like a literal scam from the 1920s, right?
Man,
Like a Ponzi scheme.
it really does. But today we're going to look at why that is a very real and actually very modern financial structure.
Yeah, it's wild.
It's one of the most fascinating and, frankly, chaotic corners of the financial markets. And it's really just one piece of a much larger puzzle we are tackling today.
Exactly. We are on a very specific mission with this one. Because we know you are out there prepping for the Series 65 exam, and today we are zooming all the way in on equity public offerings.
Right, the IPOs and all that.
Yeah, and if you've looked at the syllabus, you know this specific topic is only about 2% of the exam.
Which is what, two questions?
Roughly two questions, yeah. So my immediate thought when we were prepping this was, why are we spending a massive deep dive on a topic that might only yield two questions on a 130 question test?
Well, because the reality of this Series 65 is that the margin for error is incredibly thin. Every single point matters.
So true.
You do not want a highly testable, fundamentally logical concept to just become a blind guess on exam day. You need those 2 points.
Right, you want to walk in confident.
Exactly. But beyond just, passing the test, mastering this slice of the curriculum is about genuinely understanding the real-world mechanics of how companies raise money.
Yeah, the actual machinery.
Right, because when you become a licensed advisor, you are going to have clients calling you up. They will be asking about the latest, like, hot new tech stock that just went public.
Or some complicated blank check company they heard about on a tech blog.
Right, and you need to be able to explain the mechanics to them, and more importantly, the risks, really clearly and confidently.
That makes perfect sense. We want to actually understand how the gears turn beneath the surface. We are not just going to sit here and read textbook definitions at you today. That's boring.
No one wants that.
Exactly. To make this actually stick in your brain, we are going to follow a company's entire life cycle, from a completely strange idea in a private garage, all the way to a massive publicly traded entity.
We'll explore the initial public offerings, the secondary offerings, and yeah, that completely wild world of blank check companies I mentioned earlier.
Awesome. So to help us do that, I want to introduce you to a little cast of characters we're going to use throughout this deep dive.
I love this.
Right. Okay, first, we have Frank the founder. So Frank is this eccentric genius type. Let's say he has invented and patented a line of glow-in-the-dark Bluetooth-enabled socks.
Wow. Very necessary.
Totally game-changing. They
Yeah.
sync to your phone, they like pulse to the beat of your music, and they ensure you literally never stub your toe in the dark again.
Okay, it's a very niche market, I'll say that. But let's assume the prototype is flawless.
Oh, it's flawless. The battery life is amazing. So Frank's sock company is currently private, but he has grand ambitions. He wants to take it public so he can build a massive, I don't know, global sock factory in Europe.
Okay.
But to do this, Frank obviously needs help. He doesn't know Wall Street. So enter Dan the dealer. Dan is your slick, high-powered investment banker.
He wears the fleece vests.
Always the fleece vest. He drinks the expensive espresso and he absolutely knows how to navigate Wall Street.
Got it. Frank and Dan.
And finally, we have Alice the agent. Alice is a hardworking individual out there actually making the phone calls, dealing with clients, and facilitating the actual trades on the ground.
Okay, perfect.
So keep these three in your mind as we go: Frank the founder, Dan the dealer, and Alice the agent.
It's a really great framework. So let's start at the very beginning of Frank's journey. Frank needs a massive infusion of capital to build his European sock factory. He decides to do an initial public offering or an IPO.
The big debut.
Right. Fundamentally, an IPO is the very first time a company offers its shares to the general public. It is that exact moment of transition where Frank's company goes from being privately owned, maybe by just him and a few early angel investors, to being publicly traded on an exchange.
Now, I hear the term primary market thrown around a lot when we talk about IPOs. How does the primary market actually differ from, like, what I do on my brokerage app every day?
That is a critical distinction for the exam. When Frank's company does this IPO, it is a primary market transaction. That means the securities are being created and sold for the very first time.
Okay, brand new shares.
Brand new. The proceeds, the actual cash raised from selling these new shares, flow directly into the bank account of the issuing company. So yeah. Frank's stock empire gets the actual money to build the factory.
Right.
Contrast that with the secondary market. If you pull out your phone today and just buy a share of a massive tech company, the money you pay does not go to that tech company.
Oh, interesting.
It goes to whoever sold you that share. Another investor, a mutual fund, or a market maker. The secondary market is essentially a used car lot for stocks.
Okay, I like that. The used car lot.
Right. But the primary market is the factory floor. The shares are rolling straight off the assembly line, and the manufacturer gets the cash.
So in a primary offering, the issuer gets the proceeds. That seems like a very testable concept. I'm assuming the exam will want us to be able to identify all the different players in this primary market process, right? They love giving you a scenario and asking you, who is acting in this capacity?
Oh, they absolutely do. The four main choices you'll consistently see are issuer, broker-dealer, agent, and dealer. Or sometimes they just break out broker and dealer.
Right.
It is so vital to understand the exact legal role each of our characters is playing.
Let's map that out then. First, we have the issuer. In our story, that has to be Frank, the founder's company, right?
Correct. The issuing corporation is the entity that is actually creating the new securities. They are the ones who are legally responsible for filing all those massive regulatory documents with the Securities and Exchange Commission.
And they get the cash.
Exactly. They're the ones who ultimately receive the capital.
Okay, but Frank is a SOC genius, not a finance guy.
Yeah.
He has absolutely no idea how to find thousands of retail investors to buy millions of shares.
None at all.
So he hires Dan, the dealer's investment bank. Dan's firm is the broker-dealer, acting as the underwriter for the IPO. Now, why does that title have a hyphen? Like, what is the difference between Dan acting as a broker versus acting as a dealer?
Good question. The hyphen represents the dual capacity of the firm. An investment bank can act in two entirely different ways, depending on the specific contract they signed with Frank.
Okay, so it's situational.
Yeah. If Dan's firm acts as a broker, they're acting in an agency capacity. Think of a real estate broker.
Oh, sure. They don't buy the house.
Right. They don't buy your house. They just try to find a buyer for your house and take a commission for matching you up.
Makes sense.
But if Dan's firm acts as a dealer, they are acting in a principal capacity. This means Dan's firm actually steps up and uses its own money to buy the shares directly from Frank.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they put the shares into their own firm's inventory, and then they turn around and try to sell them out of their inventory to the public at a markup.
So a broker matches buyers and sellers, while a dealer actually buys for their own account. I can definitely see why that distinction matters for the test.
Absolutely.
What about Alice the agent? Where does she fit into this whole corporate structure?
The defining feature of an agent for the exam is that an agent is always a natural person.
A natural person, meaning human.
Yes, an individual human being representing the broker-dealer, or sometimes representing the issuer directly, to affect the actual securities transactions.
Okay, so not a building. Not an LLC.
Exactly. A firm, an entity, a corporation. These are never agents in this specific context.
Mm-hmm.
Alice is the human being picking up the phone, calling clients, and actually entering the orders.
All right, listener, let's test this with a hypothetical that feels exactly like something the exam is going to try to trick you on.
Ooh, let's do it.
Okay. Let's say Frank isn't issuing stock. Let's say he's issuing corporate bonds-like debt securities to fund his factory. The exam asks, who assigns the credit rating to this new debt issue? Mm-hmm. And your choices are the issuer, the broker, the dealer, or the agent.
Uh-huh.
So pause for a second. Think about it. Who actually assigns the rating?
I love this one because it's a classic trap. The answer is none of them.
Wait, really? None of the main players we just talked about?
None of them. The exam is testing your understanding of the boundaries of the whole distribution chain.
Right.
Think about it. The issuer, the broker dealer, and the agent are all financially invested in the successful sale of those bonds. If Frank rated his own debt, he would give his glowing socks a pristine AAA rating every single time.
Yeah, right, he's totally biased.
And if Dan rated it, he would definitely inflate the rating to make the bonds easier to sell. A credit rating, which evaluates the actual risk of default, must be assigned by an independent third-party rating agency.
Like Moody's or S&P, right?
Exactly. Organizations like Moody's, S&P, or Fitch,
yeah,
they are completely outside the issuance chain.
So if you see the phrase assigns a credit rating, you need to immediately look past the underwriter and the issuer. It has to be an independent third party. That is a great distinction.
Definitely.
So back to our story. Frank has hired Dan the dealer to underwrite his IPO. But this brings up a massive question about risk. Bringing a completely unproven company public is super dangerous.
Oh, yeah.
What if the public decides that glow-in-the-dark socks are just a stupid gimmick? What if a medical report comes out saying the Bluetooth signals cause ankle rashes?
Which would be bad for sales.
Terrible for sales. Someone has to hold the bag if these shares don't sell. How do Frank and Dan decide who actually takes on that financial risk?
That negotiation is the entire basis of what we call underwriting arrangements. It is all about risk allocation.
Mm.
The two most common arrangements you absolutely need to understand for the test are the firm commitment and the best efforts agreements.
Okay, let's put those two in a cage match and break them down. Let's say Dan looks at Frank's prototype, tries on the glowing socks, and absolutely loves them.
He's vibing to the music.
He's fully vibing. He thinks it's a guaranteed hit. If Dan offers a firm commitment arrangement, what exactly is he committing to?
In a firm commitment, Dan's investment bank guarantees Frank his money.
Nope.
Dan agrees to buy the entire new issue of stock directly from Frank's company at a negotiated discount.
Oh, wow.
Now, let's tie this back to our earlier definitions. Because Dan is buying the stock with his firm's own money into his own inventory. Is he acting as a broker or a dealer?
Well, he's using his own money, so he's acting as a principal. He's acting as a dealer.
Exactly. And because he is acting as a principal, the risk here is entirely shifted onto Dan's firm.
Because he owns the shares now.
Right. It is extremely high risk for the underwriter. If Dan buys 10 million shares and suddenly the market crashes or nobody wants the socks, Dan is stuck holding millions of dollars worth of unsellable inventory.
Ouch. And Frank?
Meanwhile, Frank is sitting comfortably on a beach because he already received his guaranteed check from Dan.
That is a sweet deal for Frank. So firm commitment means the underwriter is firmly committing their own capital. They take the risk. But what if Dan is a bit more skeptical? Like, what if he thinks the socks are cool, but maybe just a niche novelty item, and he doesn't want to risk his firm's money?
Then Dan will offer a best efforts arrangement. In this scenario, Dan essentially says, Frank, I will use my massive network and my sales team to try my absolute best to sell your shares to the public. But I am not buying them from you. Whatever I cannot sell, I am handing right back to you.
So in this case, Dan is not buying for his own inventory at all. He's just acting as a middleman.
Precisely. In a best efforts deal, the underwriter is acting purely in an agency capacity. They are a broker.
Got it.
Therefore, the risk remains almost entirely with the issuer. If the public doesn't buy the stock, Frank doesn't get his funding. Dan might lose out on some commission, but his firm's capital was never at risk.
I can totally see how the exam would heavily test that connection. So, just a recap for you listening. Firm commitment links directly to principal capacity and high risk for the underwriter. Best efforts links directly to agency capacity and high risk for the issuer.
That's the golden rule there.
But I'd imagine that just saying I'll try my best isn't always enough for a founder, right?
Not always, no.
Let's say Frank's European factory costs exactly $10 million to build. If Dan uses his best efforts but only manages to sell $6 million worth of stock, Frank is in a terrible spot.
Right, because he's short.
Yeah, he has enough money to lay the foundation and build half a factory, which is completely useless. He can't manufacture half a sock. How do they solve that problem?
That exact real-world problem is why we have conditional variations of the best efforts agreement. The two you need to know are all or none and mini-max.
All or none sounds intense.
It is. In an all or none underwriting, Dan goes out to the market and starts collecting funds from investors. But he doesn't give the shares to the investors or the money to Frank right away.
Where does it go?
He holds those funds in an independent escrow account. If Dan cannot sell every single share required to hit that exact $10 million mark by a specific deadline, the entire deal is canceled.
Just wiped out.
The escrow account is empty, the investors get their money back, and Frank gets absolutely nothing. It is a binary outcome. All of it or none of it.
Wow. But that makes sense. It protects Frank from being stuck with a half-funded, useless project, and it protects investors from buying into a company that won't actually have the capital to execute its business plan.
Exactly.
What about the mini-max?
The mini-max is similar. but it establishes a floor and a ceiling. Frank might realize he needs a minimum of $5 million to build a small functional factory. But he would ideally love $10 million to build a massive one.
Okay, so 5 is the mini, 10 is the max.
You got it. So the condition is that Dan must hit that minimum threshold of $5 million. If he fails to hit the minimum, the deal is canceled and money is returned.
Right.
But the moment he crosses that $5 million line, the offering becomes active, the funds are released from escrow, and Dan can continue using his best efforts to sell the remaining shares up to the maximum of $10 million.
Okay, so Dan is taking on different levels of risk depending on the arrangement. But let's be real, investment banks don't do this out of the goodness of their hearts. Dan wants to get paid to fund his espresso habit.
He really does.
How does the underwriter actually make money on an IPO?
They make their money through what is called the underwriting spread, or sometimes just the gross spread. Conceptually, it is very simple. It is just the difference between the price the public pays for the stock and the price the issuer actually receives.
Okay, give me an example.
Let's say Frank's stock is priced at $20 a share for the public. Frank doesn't actually receive $20. He might receive $18. That $2 difference is the gross spread.
Okay, so that $2 is the pie that Wall Street gets to eat. But how do they slice that pie up? Because I know the syllabus breaks it down into 3 specific components.
It does, and they love testing this.
Yeah.
The spread compensates different players for the specific roles they take on in the distribution process.
Okay, slice number 1.
The first slice is the manager's fee. This goes directly to Dan the dealer, who is the managing underwriter or the lead underwriter.
Yeah.
He gets this fee for doing the heavy lifting of putting the whole deal together, advising Frank, and leading the entire operation.
But Dan rarely takes down a massive IPO entirely by himself, right? Like, he usually brings in other banks to help spread the risk.
Exactly. Dan will form a syndicate, a group of other broker-dealers who partner with him, to share the financial risk of buying the shares from Frank. So the second slice of the pie is the underwriting fee.
Which goes to the syndicate.
Right. This goes to the members of the syndicate to compensate them for taking on that risk of potentially holding the bag if things go wrong.
And the final slice.
The final slice, which is usually the largest, by the way, is the selling concession. This goes to the firms and the individual brokers, like our friend Alice the agent, who actually do the legwork of calling clients and physically selling the shares to the public.
Okay, that makes sense.
Now, sometimes a firm might want to help sell the shares just to earn that concession, but they refuse to take on any of the underwriting risk. They don't want to be in the syndicate.
They just want to sell.
Right. In that case, they are just part of the selling group. They only receive the selling concession. They do not get a cut of the underwriting fee or the manager's fee.
So the spread essentially rewards the manager for organizing, the syndicate for risking capital, and the selling group for actually moving the product. That is a very clean way to look at it.
It really is.
Okay, so Frank and Dan have hashed out their underwriting agreement. They know the spread. They are ready to go. Frank files this massive, terrifying legal document called the Form S-1 Registration Statement with the SEC.
The paperwork is submitted.
Right. So does trading begin the very next morning? Can I buy the stock tomorrow?
Not even close. The moment that Form S-1 is filed, the SEC essentially throws a massive roadblock in front of the IPO. This triggers what is mandated by law as the 20-day cooling off period.
20 days.
Yes. It is a minimum of 20 days. And honestly, in the real world, it frequently takes much longer as the SEC thoroughly reviews the filing and asks for amendments.
I want to dig into the why of this cooling off period, because the SEC didn't just invent this 20-day rule to be annoying, right? Where did this come from?
To understand the cooling off period, you really have to look back at the financial landscape of the 1920s. Before the great crash of 1929, the securities markets were just the Wild West.
Like anything goes.
Completely. Companies could go public with virtually no disclosure. Investment bankers functioned as pure hype machines. They would announce a new stock, pump it up with incredible, totally unsubstantiated claims, and just sell it to the public the very same day.
That sounds like a recipe for disaster.
It was. Investors were buying entirely on emotion, momentum, and high-pressure sales tactics. They had no financial statements to review and no risk disclosures to read. When the market finally collapsed, millions of people realized they owned worthless shares in fraudulent or wildly overvalued companies.
So the Securities Act of 1933 was born out of that disaster.
Exactly. The core philosophy of the 1933 Act was forced transparency. The SEC mandated that companies must provide full and fair disclosure of all material facts. But you know, disclosure is pretty useless if investors don't have time to actually read it.
Right, if you're pressuring them to buy in 5 minutes.
Exactly. So the SEC created the 20-day cooling off period to literally cool off the hype. It forces a pause. The investment bankers are legally prohibited from aggressively selling the stock the moment it's announced. The market is given time to digest the actual information, the financials, and the risks.
Okay, so practically speaking, if I am an investor and I think Frank's glow-in-the-dark socks are going to revolutionize footwear, my immediate thought is, can I just slip down my credit card during those 20 days to lock in my shares?
No.
Like, I don't care what the final price is. I just want guaranteed allocation. Can I do that?
Absolutely not. And this is a major exam point. During the cooling-off period, there are absolutely no binding sales permitted. Underwriters cannot accept payment, they cannot hold funds in escrow, and they cannot make any formal, legally binding offers to sell.
So Dan is just sitting on his hands for 3 weeks. What's he doing?
Oh no, Dan is incredibly busy during those 20 days. The SEC prohibits formal sales, yes, but they explicitly allow specific activities to help the underwriter gauge market demand.
Okay, like what?
The most important tool Dan has during this time is the preliminary prospectus. This document is famous in finance. It is universally known as the red herring.
I have always loved the term red herring. Where does that actually come from?
It comes from the physical appearance of the document itself. Imagine a thick, dense legal booklet. On the cover page, printed vertically down the side in bright red ink, is this massive legal disclaimer.
Oh, literal red ink.
Yeah, literal red ink. It explicitly states, a registration statement relating to these securities has been filed with the SEC, but has not yet become effective. The information here is subject to completion or amendment. These securities may not be sold, nor may offers to buy be accepted prior to the time the registration statement becomes effective.
So it's a giant warning label, but what is actually in the red herring if they haven't finalized everything?
The red herring contains almost all the material information about Frank Salk Company. It has his business model, his historical financials, the background of his management team, and a brutally honest list of risk factors.
Okay, so it's a real document.
It is. But it is missing two absolutely crucial pieces of information, the final public offering price and the final effective date of the IPO.
Okay.
It might have an estimated price range, say the underwriters expect the stock to price between $15 and $18 a share, but there is no definitive final number.
And what does Dan do with this red herring? Like, who is he giving it to?
Dan goes on what was called a roadshow.
Mm-hmm.
He travels the country, or, you know, does it virtually now, pitching Frank's company to huge institutional investors, mutual fund managers, wealthy clients. He hands them the red herring and then asks them a question. After reading this, if we hypothetically price this stock at $16, how many shares would you be interested in buying?
Wait, and they are allowed to answer that during the cooling off period? I thought no sales were allowed.
They are allowed to answer yes, because they are providing what is called an indication of interest. Note the word hypothetical.
Mm-hmm.
An indication of interest is strictly non-binding for both parties. The institutional investor is not legally forced to buy those shares when the IPO happens, and Dan is not legally forced to allocate those shares to them.
So why even do it if it's not legally binding?
Because it allows the underwriter to perform a process called building the book. Dan is keeping a literal or digital book of all these non-binding pledges. He adds them up to see the total market demand.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. If Dan plans to issue 10 million shares, and his book shows that institutions want 20 million shares at $16, the IPO is oversubscribed.
Demand is huge.
Right. Dan knows demand is incredibly high, so he can confidently raise the final offering price to $18 or $19. But if the book only shows demand for 5 million shares, he knows he's in trouble, and he has to lower the price to entice more buyers. The cooling off period basically allows the market to organically discover the right price without anyone committing legally binding capital.
That makes perfect sense. They are taking the temperature of the market before jumping in. Now, aside from the red herring and gathering indications of interest, the syllabus mentions one other major thing underwriters can do during this cooling off period. They can publish a tombstone ad.
Yes, the tombstone ad is another classic exam topic. It is a brief public notice historically placed in major financial newspapers like the Wall Street Journal.
Why is it called a tombstone?
It gets its name because of its stark, unadorned appearance. It literally looks like a block of text on a tombstone. It has heavy black borders and contains absolutely no graphics, no pictures, no marketing flair.
And I imagine the exam will try to trick you into thinking a tombstone ad is like a promotional marketing tool.
Exactly. The exam might suggest a tombstone ad is used to drum up retail hype. It is not. Legally, a tombstone ad is not an offer to sell. It cannot contain any promotional language. Dan cannot write, "Don't miss out on the sock revolution of the century."
Too bad.
The SEC tightly restricts what can be in a tombstone ad. It only states the absolute bare-bones facts. The name of the issuer, the type of security being offered, the number of shares, the estimated price range, and the names of the underwriting syndicate members. That's it. It is merely an announcement of a factual event, not a sales pitch.
Okay, so the 20 days pass. Dan has built his book. Frank's paperwork is flawless. The SEC has scoured the form S-1. They checked the math. They read all the risk disclosures. Everything looks accurate and transparent. This brings us to what I think is one of the biggest psychological traps on the exam. So listen closely. Does the SEC then look at all this and officially approve Frank's sock company as a good, safe investment?
I cannot stress this enough. Never.
Never.
The SEC never, ever approves an offering. They never pass judgment on the investment merits of a company. They never say, yes, glow-in-the-dark socks are a sound financial decision, and this company is well-run.
But if they are reviewing it for 20 days, what are they actually doing if not approving it? Like, what's the point?
The SEC's mandate is solely about disclosure, not quality control. Think of them like a meticulous spell checker, not a literary critic.
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
They just want to ensure that Frank did not lie and that he did not omit any material facts that an investor would need to make an informed decision.
So they don't care if it's a bad business?
Not at all. If Frank clearly states on page 42 of his prospectus, there was a 50% probability our socks will spontaneously catch fire, resulting in massive lawsuits and the immediate bankruptcy of this company, the SEC will basically say, great, you disclosed the risk accurately, the public has been warned, you may proceed. They don't care if it's a terrible investment, as long as the public knows exactly how terrible it is.
So what is the exact terminology the exam wants us to look for, if not the word approved?
When the SEC is satisfied that the disclosure is complete, they declare the registration statement effective. Effective means the legal barrier to selling has been lifted.
Right.
If you are taking the Series 65 and you see any answer choice that says the SEC approved the security or endorsed the security or guaranteed the accuracy of the prospectus, you must cross it out immediately. It is always 100% of the time the wrong answer.
Okay, the SEC declares it effective. Got it. Now, what happens if the SEC does find a lie during their review? Let's say they discover Frank secretly owes $5 million to an underground loan shark and just, you know, didn't mention it.
Well, if the SEC finds material misstatements, omissions, or outright fraud during the cooling off period, they will issue what is called a stop order. A stop order immediately suspends the effectiveness of the registration. The IPO is frozen in its tracks until the company amends the documents and fixes the lies.
Yikes. But assuming Frank was honest about the socks, the SEC declares it effective. The final public offering price is locked in. The final prospectus is generated, which, by the way, must be delivered to all buyers at or before the time of their purchase. And the sale finally happens.
Boom.
The primary market transaction is complete. Frank's company gets its millions. Which brings us to the next phase. Life after the IPO.
Right. The dust is settled.
The stock is now trading openly on the secondary market. People are buying and selling Frank's sock stock on their Robinhood apps or whatever. Frank is absolutely thrilled. His corporate bank account is flush with cash to build his European factory.
Good for Frank.
But Frank himself is also personally wealthy now, right? Let's say Frank still owns 2 million shares of his own founder stock. At a $20 IPO price, Frank is sitting on a $40 million of equity.
Not bad.
Not bad at all. Naturally, the morning after the IPO, Frank is going to log into his brokerage account, hit sell all, buy a massive mega yacht, and retire to the Bahamas. Right? Like, that's the dream.
He might want to, but he can't. And that specific scenario is exactly why post-IPO restrictions exist.
Why? What happens if he sells?
Well, if Frank, the founder, the visionary, the public face of the company, decides to dump all of his personal shares on the very first day of trading, two disastrous things will happen. First, the basic laws of supply and demand kick in. A massive sudden influx of 2 million shares hitting the market will completely overwhelm the buyers, and the stock price will crater instantly.
Right. The new retail investors who just bought in at $20 are suddenly holding a stock worth $5.
Exactly. It's a bloodbath. And the second issue is the psychological signal it sends to the broader market. If the founder is bailing out and cashing in his chips the literal second the company goes public, Why on earth should the retail public hold the stock? It looks like a classic pump and dump scheme.
It looks super sketchy. So to prevent this chaos, we have something called the lockup period. Explain how that works.
The lockup period is a predefined window of time, typically 90 to 180 days immediately following the IPO, during which company insiders, executives like Frank, and early venture capital investors are strictly prohibited from selling their personal shares on the secondary market.
Now, I can hear the exam trying to trap me here. Let me think. The SEC regulates the cooling off period. The SEC regulates the prospectus. So it's totally logical to assume the SEC enforces this lockup period to protect retail investors, right?
Well, it is entirely logical, but it is completely wrong. And the exam will definitely test that.
Oh, sneaky.
Very. The SEC does not mandate the lockup period. It is not a federal securities law. The lockup is entirely a contractual agreement between the insiders, like Frank, and the managing underwriter, Dan.
Wait, really? Why does Dan care so much that he legally forces Frank to sign a contract restricting his own stock?
Because Dan's professional reputation and his firm's future revenue is completely on the line.
Oh, because of the roadshow?
Exactly. Remember the book building we talked about? Dan just spent weeks traveling the country, looking his most important institutional clients in the eye, and convincing them to buy millions of dollars of Frank's stock at $20 a share. If Frank dumps his shares and crashes the price on day two, Dan's clients are going to take a massive loss. They will be furious. They will never buy an IPO from Dan's investment bank ever again.
So, to protect his own relationships and to ensure the stock price has time to stabilize in the secondary market, Dan legally forces Frank to sign a contract saying, you will not sell a single share for 180 days.
Precisely. It's self-preservation for the underwriter.
That is a crucial distinction. The lockup is a contractual agreement to stabilize the market, not a regulatory mandate from the SEC. Good to know.
Yeah.
There is also a brief mention in the syllabus of a quiet period after the IPO. How does that differ from the lockup?
So the quiet period restricts the flow of information, not the flow of shares. After an IPO, there are strict rules preventing the underwriters from publishing overly optimistic research reports or public recommendations about the newly public company for a certain number of days.
Why is that?
The rationale is that Dan's firm just made millions of dollars taking Frank public. If Dan's analysts immediately start publishing reports screaming, strong buy, target price $100, it looks like they're just acting as a cheerleading squad, artificially pumping up the stock price they just helped sell.
Right, it's a conflict of interest.
Exactly. The quiet period forces the underwriters to step back and let the market digest the company objectively for a bit.
Okay, let's advance our timeline. Fast forward 6 months. The 180-day lockup period finally expires. Frank is now legally allowed to sell his personal shares and buy that yacht if he wants to.
Yes, he is.
Or let's imagine a totally different scenario. A year goes by. The European sock factory is booming. Frank's company decides they want to expand into Asia. So the company itself needs to raise even more money from the public.
Two very common situations.
Right. And these two distinct scenarios lead us directly into a highly testable area of the exam. Understanding the difference between dilutive versus non-dilutive offerings, or, to use the industry terms, secondary versus follow-on offerings.
This is a massive area for confusion because the terminology feels so counterintuitive. The exam will absolutely try to trip you up on the word secondary.
How so?
Well, the best way to understand the mechanical difference here is to use a visual analogy. Let's look at Frank's equity in his sock company, like a giant pizza. The total value of Frank's company is represented by the whole pizza. Right now, let's say the company has 1 million shares outstanding, and we will imagine that pizza is cut into 8 giant slices.
Okay, 8 slices.
If you own one slice, you own 1/8 of the total company.
Okay, let's start with the scenario where Frank finally wants his yacht. This leads to a secondary offering. How does that work?
A secondary offering occurs when existing shareholders, like Frank the founder, or maybe an early venture capital firm, decide to sell a large block of the shares they already own to the public.
Let me pause and ask a mechanical question here for you listening. If Frank decides to sell 100,000 of his personal shares in a secondary offering, who gets the money from those sales? Does the cash go into the sock company's corporate treasury to build more factories, or does it go to Frank?
It goes directly into Frank's personal bank account.
Okay.
The selling shareholder receives the proceeds, not the issuer.
Mm.
The company itself gets absolutely $0 from a secondary offering.
Now let's map that back to the pizza. In a secondary offering, Frank is simply taking his existing slice of the pizza and he is selling it to a new investor. Did the pizza get any bigger? No. Do we bake any new dough? No. The total number of slices in the world stays exactly the same.
Right.
Therefore, a secondary offering is completely non-dilutive. It does not dilute the ownership percentage of any other shareholder. If I own 10% of the company before Frank sold his shares, I still own 10% of the company after he sells his shares.
That is exactly right.
Yeah.
And here's where the exam trap comes in. The logical trap people fall into is thinking primary means the first time they raise money, so secondary must mean the second time the company raises money.
Oh, that sounds so logical.
It does, but that is wrong. Secondary offering does not mean chronological order. Secondary means the shares are coming from secondary sources, meaning existing shareholders, not from the primary issuer creating new shares.
Excellent. So what happens when the company does want to raise money a second time, when they want to build that factory in Asia?
That is called a follow-on offering. You might also see it referred to as an additional primary offering or a seasoned equity offering on the test.
Okay.
In a follow-on offering, the issuing company Frank's Sock Empire decides to legally create brand new shares out of thin air and sell them to the public to raise fresh capital. Because the company is issuing new securities, the issuer receives the proceeds.
Let's bring the pizza back. The company needs money, but they don't bake a second pizza. The total underlying value of the company's current assets remains the same. But to sell new shares, they just take the existing pizza and they slice it up into 16 slices instead of 8.
Right.
They take those 8 brand new slices and sell them to new investors. What happened to your original slice? It didn't physically leave your plate, but suddenly it represents a much smaller fraction of the whole pie. Your ownership percentage of the company just shrank.
Mechanically, because new shares are created and added to the total pool of outstanding stock, a follow-on offering is dilutive to existing shareholders. Your piece of the pie is now smaller relative to the whole, and usually the earnings per share drops because the profits are divided among more total shares.
Let's summarize that contrast because it is vital for exam day. Follow-on offering, new shares are created, the issuer gets the cash, and it is dilutive to existing owners.
Yeah.
Secondary offering, existing shares are sold, the selling shareholder gets the cash, and it is strictly non-dilutive.
Perfect. Now, just as a heads up, in the real world, things are rarely that cleanly separated. You will frequently see what is called a combined offering. This is where a transaction does both simultaneously.
Like at the same time.
Yeah. For example, the prospectus might announce an offering of 5 million shares. The document will specify that 3 million are brand new shares issued by the company to fund expansion. So that's the primary dilutive part. The remaining 2 million are existing shares being cashed out by early investors like Frank. That's the secondary, non-dilutive part.
And the SEC is fine with that as long as it's fully disclosed. The prospectus will explicitly break down exactly who gets what slice of the cash. Transparency is the only rule.
Exactly.
Okay. I want you to take a deep breath. Shake off everything we just talked about.
Deep breath.
Forget the meticulous, highly regulated, heavily scrutinized 20-day cooling off process. Forget the detailed Form S-1 that explains exactly how a company makes money. Forget the road shows where Dan has to convince investors that Frank's socks are a viable business.
Forget it all.
We are leaving the traditional IPO world and we are entering Section 6, the Wild West.
Oh boy.
Let's imagine an alternate universe. Frank wants to go public. He goes to Dan the dealer. But instead of an IPO, Dan says, Frank, the IPO process takes a year. It's exhausting. The SEC scrutinizes everything. I have a faster way. I already have a massive pile of public money sitting in a bank account. I'll just buy you.
Okay.
And then Dan turns to you, the investor, and says, hey, give me $10 million right now. You ask, what are you going to do with my money? Dan says, I have absolutely no idea, but trust me, I'm a smart guy. In a couple of years, I'll find a really cool company to buy. Give me the check.
And incredibly, investors hand over billions of dollars based on that exact pitch. Welcome to the world of the SPAC, S-P-A-C. The Special Purpose Acquisition Company.
SPACs exploded in popularity over the last few years. They became a cultural phenomenon, and because of that, they are now heavily tested on exams. The regulators want to ensure you understand them because their mechanics are completely inverted from a traditional IPO.
Totally backwards.
Yeah.
Let's define the core concept clearly. A SPAC is a shell company. It has no commercial operations. It sells no products. It has no revenue. It has no intellectual property. And it has no assets whatsoever other than the giant pile of cash it just raised in its own initial public offering.
Just a pile of cash.
Its sole special purpose for existing is to take that cash and acquire or merge with a real private operating company at some point in the future.
You will frequently hear SPACs referred to as blank check companies or blind pools. And those terms are not exaggerations. They are literal descriptions of the risk profile.
Exactly.
When you invest in a SPAC IPO, you are writing Dan the dealer a blank check. You are diving headfirst into a blind pool because you, the investor, are completely blind to what the ultimate target company will be. You aren't evaluating a business model because there isn't one yet. You are betting entirely on the reputation and the deal-making skill of the SPAC sponsors, the management team led by Dan.
Technically, under SEC rules, all SPACs are classified as a type of blank check company, and they raise their initial capital as a blind pool. As an advisor, you have to realize that the risk profile of buying a SPAC is structurally different from buying shares in a company that already manufactures actual goods.
Let's walk through the exact life cycle of a SPAC step by step so we can see how bizarre and fascinating the structure really is.
Let's do it.
Step one, the SPAC IPO. The shell company itself goes public, but they don't usually sell just common stock. What are investors actually buying?
They sell what are called units. And these units are almost universally priced at exactly $10.
Okay, 10 bucks.
A unit typically consists of one common share of the SPAC shell plus a fraction of a warrant. A warrant is a derivative instrument that gives the investor the right to buy more stock from the company later at a specific predetermined price.
Why throw in the warrant? Like, what's the point?
It acts as a sweetener. You are asking investors to park their money in a dead shell company for years. The warrant gives them extra upside potential to entice them to tie up their capital.
Okay, step two, the trust. The SPAC just raised hundreds of millions of dollars by selling these $10 units. I assume Dan doesn't just put that cash in his personal checking account to go party in Vegas while he looks for a company.
No, the SEC does have some guardrails here. The vast majority of that IPO money is placed into an interest-bearing escrow account known as the trust. It sits there, locked up safely, earning a very conservative yield, usually invested in short-term U.S. treasuries.
Okay, that's safe. Step three, the target search. The money is locked up. Now the sponsors have a ticking clock.
Exactly. The sponsors typically have an 18 to 24-month window to scour the earth, find a private company like Frank's glow-in-the-dark stock company, and negotiate a merger. During this entire search phase, the retail investor's capital is just sitting in the trust. The main risk here is opportunity cost. That $10 could have been invested in the S&P 500 earning a return, but instead, it is frozen in a blind pool waiting for Dan to do his job.
Step four, the de-SPAC and the vote. Let's say Dan, the dealer, searches for a year. He finds Frank. He thinks the socks are the future. They agree on a valuation and they announce the merger.
This process of merging the shell company with the real operating company is called the de-SPAC process. Hmm. The shell falls away, and Frank's sock company essentially takes over the public listing.
Okay.
But before that final merger happens, they have to announce the target to the SPAC shareholders and hold a proxy vote. They ask the investors, do you want to merge with this sock company?
And this brings us to an incredible structural feature of a SPAC and a massive area for exam questions. Let's do a scenario for you listening. Let's say you bought SPAC units a year ago. You gave Dan your $10. Today, Dan announces the target, but it's not Frank Sox. Dan announces he is merging with a company that manufactures lead balloons. It's a phenomenally terrible idea. The financials are awful. You hate it. You vote a resounding NO on the merger proxy. Can you get your $10 back?
The answer is yes. You have the right to redeem your shares.
Okay, let's twist it. What if the majority of people vote yes, the merger is approved, but you personally voted yes because you wanted to be supportive, but you don't actually want to own the lead balloon company long term? Can you vote yes and still get your money back?
Yes. And this is the concept that breaks people's brains. So let's make it crystal clear. In a SPAC, voting rights and redemption rights are entirely separate and decoupled.
Decoupled.
You can redeem your shares for your pro rata portion of the trust, which is roughly your original $10 plus the accrued interest, regardless of how you vote on the merger.
Let me repeat that. You can vote yes, say, I approve this merger, and then immediately turn around to the sponsor and say, but I don't want to actually own the post-merger company, so I'm exercising my redemption right. Give me my $10 back.
You can vote yes and redeem. You can vote no and redeem. You don't even have to vote at all, and you can still redeem. The redemption right is your ultimate structural protection against the blind pool risk. You bought in blind, but once the target is finally revealed, if you don't like the valuation or the business model, you hit the eject button. You get your trust money back and you walk away.
Which naturally leads to step five, liquidation. What if Dan searches for two entire years and finds absolutely nothing? the 24-month clock expires.
If the clock runs out, the SPAC is forced to liquidate. The corporate shell is dissolved, and all the money sitting in the trust is returned to the shareholders, roughly $10 a share.
Now, listening to that life cycle, this structure sounds somewhat safe for the retail investor. You buy it for $10, the money sits in a secure trust. If they find a bad company, you redeem for $10. If they find no company, it liquidates, and you get your $10 back.
That didn't sound safe.
Right. But the regulators are very concerned about SPACs. The exam wants you to know the major structural flaws and hidden risks. And the biggest risk revolves around the SPAC sponsors. Let's talk about the term sponsor promote. What is that?
So Dan, the dealer, and his management team do not work for free. They spend time and their own upfront capital setting up the legal structure of the SPAC. Their compensation for finding a target is called the promote.
And it's big.
And the promote is massive.
Yeah.
Typically, the sponsors are granted 20% of the total post-IPO shares of the SPAC. And they receive these shares at a nominal price, virtually zero cost.
Let's do the math on that to show how crazy it is. Imagine the SPAC raises $100 million from the public. The public owns 100% of the shares based on the cash they put in. But immediately, the sponsors just legally print an extra $25 million worth of shares and hand them to themselves for pennies.
Exactly. Going back to our pizza analogy, the pizza just got 20% bigger, but all the new slices went to Dan the dealer for free.
Wow.
This creates massive instantaneous dilution for the public shareholders. Even before a merger target is found, the $10 you put in is mathematically worth less because the sponsors have taken a huge slice of the equity without contributing proportional cash to the trust.
It's brutal dilution, but it actually gets worse. That promote creates a terrifying conflict of interest. This is the ultimate SAC risk you need to understand for the Series 65. Let's look at Dan's incentives. If the SAPKIC fails to find a target within 24 months, it liquidates. The retail investors get their $10 back. But what does Dan get?
Dan gets nothing. If the SPAC liquidates, the 20% sponsor promote is infinitely voided. It becomes completely worthless. Furthermore, Dan loses the millions of dollars in upfront capital he spent on lawyers and underwriting fees to set the SPAC up in the first place.
Therefore, the sponsors are intensely structurally incentivized to close any deal. Even a terrible deal, even merging with a fraudulent company or a company that makes lead balloons.
Right.
Because if Dan forces a bad deal through, his 20% promote converts into actual tradable shares in the newly public company. Those shares might drop in value, but 20% of a bad company is still worth millions of dollars on paper. If he liquidates, he gets zero.
The structure mathematically incentivizes the management team to push through terrible acquisitions at inflated valuations rather than admit defeat and return the money.
That is wild.
And historically, over the last few years, this exact conflict of interest has played out repeatedly in the real markets. Many post-merger SPAC companies have seen their stock prices plummet 80 or 90% shortly after the de-SPAC process.
Because the companies were terrible.
Right. The retail investors who believed the hype and forgot to redeem their shares were left holding the bag, watching their $10 investment drop to $2. Meanwhile, the sponsors who got their shares for free still walked away with a profit.
It really is an inverted model compared to the forced transparency of the 1933 Act.
It really is.
Okay, we have covered a massive amount of ground today. We followed Frank's SOX from a private garage to a fully syndicated IPO, and we explored the alternate reality of blind pools and blank checks. Let's shift gears. It is time for the rapid fire recap.
My favorite part.
I want you, the listener, to actively try to answer these as we fire them off. These are the core, mechanical, highly testable takeaways you need etched into your brain for exam day.
Ready? First up, what kind of transaction is an IPO?
It is a primary market transaction. The issuer creates new shares and the issuer receives the proceeds.
Second, does the SEC approve an IPO?
No. The SEC is a spell checker, not a critic. They never approve or endorse an offering. They only declare the registration effective once full disclosure is met.
Third, let's talk underwriting risk. What does a firm commitment mean?
Firm commitment means the underwriter acts as a principal or dealer, buying the shares into their own inventory. This is high risk for the underwriter.
And best efforts.
Best efforts means the underwriter acts as an agent or broker matching buyers. The capital risk remains with the issuer.
Fourth, role definitions. What is the defining characteristic of an agent?
An agent is always a natural person, and if a question asks who assigns a credit rating to a bond, ignore the main cast, it has to be an independent third-party rating agency.
Fifth, The cooling off period, how long is it and what can you do?
It is a minimum of 20 days. During this time, there are absolutely no sales and no money accepted. Underwriters can only distribute preliminary red herrings, collect non-binding indications of interest to build the book, and publish factual tombstone ads.
Sixth, offerings after the IPO. What is a secondary offering?
The secondary offering involves existing shares being sold by current owners. The selling shareholder gets the cash, and it is strictly non-dilutive to other owners.
And what is a follow-on or primary offering?
A follow-on involves creating brand new shares. The issuing company gets the cash, and it is heavily dilutive to existing shareholders.
Finally, SPACs, what are they?
They are blind pools and blank check companies. Structurally, you can vote yes on a merger and still exercise your right to redeem your shares for your trust value. And watch out for the sponsors. They get a massive 20% promote, which causes immediate dilution and creates a severe conflict of interest to force bad deals just to get paid.
Boom. That covers the core testable mechanics of equity public offerings. Mm-hmm. But before we sign off, I want to step outside the textbook for just a moment and leave you with a broader thought.
Okay, let's hear it.
Think about the evolution of the capital markets we just discussed. In the 1930s, regulators looked at the devastation of the stock market crash and deliberately created this massive, heavily regulated 20-day IPO cooling off process.
Right.
They built an entire system based on forced patience and exhaustive disclosure. It was designed specifically to protect the public from buying into bad, overhyped companies.
Makes sense.
But then, decades later, the market innovated around those friction points and popularized the SPAC. It is literally a legal vehicle where you write a blank check for a blind pool, buy a shell company with no financials, and just hope for the best based on a sponsor's reputation. It bypassed almost all that initial friction that the 1930s regulators built.
That's a crazy shift.
It proves a fundamental truth about finance. Wall Street will always innovate new, faster, and sometimes significantly riskier ways to move capital from your pocket into the market. The drive for speed, efficiency, and profit is relentless.
Yeah, it's not going away.
No, it's not. And as a future Series 65 licensed advisor, your job isn't just to memorize these rules so you can pass a multiple choice test. Your job is to act as the translator for your clients. You have to translate that rapid, complex financial innovation back into understandable, tangible risk. When your client calls you up asking about the shiny new SPAC they saw trending online, you have to be the one to look past the hype. You have to explain the sponsor promote, the mechanics of dilution, and the reality of investing in a blind pool. You are the vanguard protecting their financial future from the things they don't fully understand.
That is exactly right. And that's why we dive this deep. The mechanics matter because the real world impact on people's livelihoods matters.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the machinery of equity public offerings. Keep grinding on your prep. Keep that curiosity sharp. And we will see you on the next one. Keep studying.